A small dark grey MG sports car pulls up to the gates inside the Harwell Nuclear Energy Research Centre. The driver gives a familiar nod to the security guard in the box and the gates swing open. At the wheel is atomic physicist Klaus Fuchs. Next to him, his friend and boss, Herbert Skinner. They drive down an Oxfordshire country lane carpeted in golden leaves, on their way to a meeting at the General Electric Company on the outskirts of London. Does Klaus Fuchs notice, in his rearview mirror, when another car slips out of a lay-by and starts to follow them? Does he register the three men inside the car? Later that evening, when Fuchs returns home, having said goodbye to Skinner, does he suspect that there are people listening to his every movement as he stokes the fire or prepares his dinner?
When the phone was put back on its cradle, it didn't cut off. That allowed them to hear whatever was being said in the room, in both his office and his home. They also looked at his mail. They checked for invisible ink. They checked everything they could.
And when, later in the evening, there's a covert knock on the door, the unseen audience listens as Fuchs gets up and lets in his female guest. What they say to each other isn't clear, but it is clear that they both retire to the couch. The listener records that Fuchs stokes the fire and that the woman makes the occasional murmur. MI5 are learning very little about Klaus Fuchs's atomic espionage for the Soviets. But they are now privy to the affair he's having with Erna Skinner, the wife of his boss. From the BBC World Service, I'm Rosa Ellis, and this is Season 2 of The Bomb. Episode 8, The Uncertainty Principle. The chain of events that led MI5 towards their target owes much to chance and to human error, but none of it has been Klaus Fuchs's error. In the end, it's the Russian intelligence services that let him down. In wartime Washington, D.C., the Soviet embassy had passed secret information about undercover agents back to Moscow via coded signals. The Americans were able to intercept the messages, but they were encrypted with a code that changed every time. Except when they didn't. The Russian manufacturer that made the one-time encryption pads had duplicated some during the war to keep up with the demand. American cryptographers spotted the random and sporadic duplications, making the uncrackable crackable. In Arlington, Virginia, the Americans put their best cryptographers and linguists to work, unearthing a hoard of Soviet secrets known as the Venona cables. It's painstakingly slow and arduous work.
You might have one sentence or one word out of it in 1 week, and then 2 weeks later, you manage to break out another sentence or two.
Intelligence expert Nigel West.
So the Venona source was developing all the time. And that is why when there was very clear evidence from 1944 onwards of considerable penetration of the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, including the real names of nuclear physicists based there who had operated under alias, this was cast iron evidence of Soviet espionage, and that created a huge need for investigation both in the United States and the United Kingdom. And specifically, one individual emerged, codename was Rest.
And Agent Rest had joined the Manhattan Project with the British mission in 1944. The discovery of this mole 5 years later causes huge political ructions. In Washington, J. Edgar Hoover, the notoriously paranoid head of the FBI, is furious that Britain allowed a spy into the nuclear program. The Brits have reason to be worried. Remember MI5's advice to the British government not to disclose to the Americans Fuchs's communist proclivities? Remember their blithe assessment that he wouldn't be able to make contact with communists in the US? Well, paper leaves a trail, and these are blunders MI5 want to leave buried. For the Brits, the timing couldn't be worse. Following the war, America pulled up the drawbridge and severely limited nuclear cooperation with its former allies. Cindy Kelly from the Atomic Heritage Foundation.
The relationship between the United States and its very close ally in World War II, Great Britain, was horribly rocky. Partly, it was because of fear of espionage. So they didn't trust anyone, including Great Britain. 1946, this was inscribed in the new Atomic Energy Act that prohibited sharing information, even with those scientists that actually worked on the bomb from Britain and Canada. So the British scientists were out in the cold.
But by 1949, this is starting to change. The Americans have a problem. The Cold War is heating up, and they know it's only a matter of time till the Russians have the bomb. When that inevitability arrives, they still want to have the strategic advantage. So they set out to rapidly expand their own nuclear arsenal. And here, Britain spies an opportunity to bring itself in from the cold. The US has a major shortage of uranium ore.
So there was an agreement that in exchange for having greater access to British stockpiles of uranium, the United States agreed to begin to share and return to that greater collegiality that they had among the scientists during the wartime period, during the Manhattan Project.
Agent Rest threatens the very foundations of this resurgent British-American cooperation, and the Brits know it. The original intel has come from the US, but it's down to Britain to find out who Agent Rest actually is. The two prime suspects are the old friends, Rudolf Peierls and Klaus Fuchs. Both are put under close surveillance. And then within a fortnight, the successful test of a Soviet atomic bomb comes years ahead of what any Western intelligence had predicted. Suddenly, the possibility of nuclear war is horribly real. America's monopoly on nuclear weapons has been broken, and it's a British spy who made it possible. What's more, the British government is worried that America's isolationism will lead them into a new war with the Soviets, in which Britain would be the obvious target. It's a cluster catastrophe unfolding in slow motion for the Brits. And still, the identity of the spy is unknown. At Harwell, MI5 throws everything at trying to ensnare Fuchs.
They used every single method that they had at their disposal.
Author Mike Rossiter.
They would bug his premises, his bungalow, the letter watch. They put a tap on his telephone and they had people ready to follow him on his journeys. And they did.
MI5 logs every detail of his daily life, down to the time he eats breakfast, stokes the fire and goes to bed. The Venona cables are top secret and can't be used as evidence. Only a very select few people in MI5 even know they exist, so they have to catch him red-handed. A growing list of unsuspecting people around Fuchs get drawn into the web of surveillance.
Has Fuchs met somebody that they didn't have a personal file on in MI5? A personal file was opened. Searches were done. A detailed information about their background was drawn up. Their phones were tapped. Sometimes their mail was intercepted. It grew and grew and grew. By the end of the first three-month period of surveillance, they were probably looking at 57 people in an attempt to discover whether and how Klaus Fuchs was spying for the Russians.
I've got a memory of when I was a child, of my granddad telling me his phone was bugged and that people were listening in. I didn't really know what he meant at the time. I was too young to understand. But then years later, I went to the National Archives at Kew and read records of his conversations. MI5 monitored my granny and granddad for years because of their connection to Ursula and their own communist activities. But in the days before satellites, drones and smartphones, catching a spy is no easy matter, especially when the spy isn't spying. Klaus Fuchs has cut his contact with Soviet intelligence.
In the post-war period, I began to have my doubts about Russian policy. I came to a point when I knew I disapproved of a great many actions of the Russian government and of the Communist Party. But I still believed that they would build a new world, that one day I would take part in it.
Not only is Fuchs's faith in the Soviet Union wavering, but he's coming to feel a deep sense of affinity for the English. Maybe it's the softening of convictions and prejudice that can come with age. Or maybe it's the depth of relations that he's forming at Harwell. Whatever the reason, his worldview is now less rigid, less dogmatic. The clear-cut lines in his mind, cast by the threat of Nazism, are becoming blurred, and that grey zone is causing him to doubt the morality of his spying. Fuchs may have cut contact with the Russians, but he can't afford to relax. He knows that British intelligence are on the hunt for Soviet spies, and his KGB hander, Alexander Feklisov, has told him about MI5's surprise visit to his former handler, my great-aunt Ursula. On a trip to the Royal Academy in London, he lays a trap to confirm his suspicions. After the meeting, he decides not to go straight back to Harwell, but hangs around in central London.
He wanders around Soho, goes into an amusement arcade, hangs around there for 45 minutes, wanders along, then goes in to what can only be described as a dirty bookshop.
When he emerges, he has a parcel under his arm. He meanders slowly past the shops on Oxford Street and then waits patiently for a bus. He normally takes a taxi, but this time he's got other plans. When the bus stops, he hops on. And then halfway up the stairs,
he drops the brown paper bag, which has got a copy of Health and Strength in it, which is a sub-pornographic male nude magazine. The operative who's closely behind him picks it up in its brown paper bag. And instead of saying, "Excuse me, you've dropped this," as any normal person perhaps might, he doesn't. He keeps it and takes it back to headquarters in the vain belief and hope that it may actually contain some secret information and incriminate Fuchs. It doesn't, of course.
All it's done is let Fuchs know that MI5 are onto him. MI5 are getting desperate, and the Americans are getting impatient. The operation is draining resources, and despite umpteen reports detailing Klaus Fuchs's eating habits, secret rendezvous with Ernest Skinner, or routine professional meetings, they don't have a shred of evidence on him. There are no dead letter drops, suspicious liaisons, or coded messages. And there aren't going to be any. Fuchs has all the time in the world to sit tight and ride it out.
MI5 followed Fuchs in every minute that they could for 6 weeks and came up with nothing.
Here's Nancy Thorndike Greenspan, the author of Atomic Spy, The Dark Lives of Klaus Fuchs.
They were stretched so thin and they were stressed hugely because they were failing. They didn't know what to do about the situation. They knew they could not continue because they were burning out everybody. And there was nothing to show for it. And there was only so long they could go on with this.
MI5's surveillance operation may be failing miserably, but they're still diligently cross-referencing new bits of intel related to the Venona cables. Whiskey, cigarettes and coffee oil the operation until finally they make a major breakthrough. They've scoured all the records and compiled a timeline for Rudolf Pauls' movements. They conclude he was in Los Alamos when Agent Rest passed a report titled MSN 12 to Harry Gold in New York. There can only be one conclusion. Rudolf Pauls could not be Agent Rest. They finally know, beyond all reasonable doubt, that Fuchs is their man. This only adds to the frustration, though. MI5 can't disclose the Venona source or use it in the court of law. They have the smoking gun, but they can't reveal it. So even though they know he's guilty, to make it stick, they either need to catch Fuchs red-handed or they need him to confess.
They knew he was a risk. They knew he couldn't stay at Harwell. They had to do something about that. They couldn't just fire him. They didn't want to raise questions about why he would have to leave. They were in a real dilemma about how to get rid of him.
MI5 are faced with only bad options. They have no way to limit his access to top secret information at Harwell, no grounds for legal prosecution, and no simple administrative way to remove him. And they still have the Americans breathing down their neck. But then, out of nowhere, they're thrown a lifeline by Klaus Fuchs himself. In late 1949, his father, Emil, is offered a post at the University of Leipzig in communist East Germany. Having a close relative in Soviet-controlled territory would potentially put Fuchs in a vulnerable position, leaving him open to blackmail. He realises this and raises the issue with Harwell's head of security, Henry Arnold.
Hello.
He asks Arnold if he should discourage his father from taking the post. Arnold listens intently and tells Fuchs he needs time to think about it. He then swiftly proceeds to report everything back to MI5. They deliberate, discuss and debate why Fuchs has offered this information voluntarily. Some argue that they just need to cut a gentleman's agreement. Why hang out the dirty laundry to dry and risk an embarrassing failure if they can quietly get Fuchs out the back door and away from sensitive research? A transfer to a quiet university post, or at worst, a dismissal from Harwell. But the head of MI5 has other ideas.
Percy Sillitoe had been a chief constable in Glasgow. There were a lot of gangs there at that time in the 30s and 40s. And he was a policeman's policeman, and he wanted to get his criminal.
He smells blood, and he wants a conviction. MI5 decide it's time for a direct confrontation. And here Jim Scarden re-enters the story. The MI5 officer who bungled his interrogation of my great aunt Ursula. The man who was so transparent and blunt in his approach that she almost laughed in his face. Well, when MI5 decide to interview Klaus Fuchs, it's Scarden they put on the job. Will he have better luck this time? At 11 a.m. on December 21st, 1949, head of Harwell Security, Henry Arnold, knocks on Fuchs's door.
Dr. Fuchs, sorry to disturb you. There's been a telephone.
He tells him somebody wants to speak to him about his father.
Would you have a moment to come back with me to the office?
For 3 months previously, he'd become aware of quite an intense tailing and surveillance operation around him. So Fuchs would have been more or less mentally prepared for something like this to happen.
Fuchs politely agrees, and when they arrive, Arnold introduces Fuchs to a tall, stern-faced man he calls Jim Seddon. He has a pencil moustache and a pipe hanging from between his lips. He is the quintessential embodiment of the British establishment. It is, of course, Scarden. Arnold excuses himself, and the two men get down to business.
Fuchs started to tell him his story. Went back to the fact that he had been active politically in Germany, didn't mention that it had joined the Communist Party, but said that he'd been active in socialist politics as a student, went on to describe his various roles, said he'd been interned, obviously.
So far, so predictable. But then after an hour or so of dancing on the head of a pin, Scarden tries the same curveball he threw at my aunt Ursula.
Scarden suddenly interrupted and said, "We know you're a spy."
"I'm in possession of precise information which shows that you've been guilty of espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union. For example, during your time in New York, you passed to them information concerning your work."
But this is a bluff. Scarden has nothing. Fuchs hesitates for a moment. Then there's a flicker of a smile before he replies,
I don't think so.
Which is quite a strange response. Klaus is prepared for this interview, so I don't think so. It's hardly a convincing denial. But it turns out Skardon may have done a little massaging of the truth himself.
The deputy director of MI5 kept a diary, and he was briefed on all of this by Skardon the next day. His diary has a different tone to what went on at that particular moment. And he wrote, finally, Skardon came to the point when he suggested that Fuchs had been passing information to the Russians. Fuchs smiled and said he didn't quite understand. Skardon then put the point quite bluntly. When Fuchs denied flatly that he'd ever done anything of the kind, he could not see why he would want to.
Skardon pushes on, drawing on fragments of circumstantial evidence. He even mentions Fuchs's sister Crystal in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Fuchs stifles a flutter of fear. Crystal has been involved, indirectly, in his spying, and he worries he's put her and her young children in danger. But Skardon is vague and can't provide anything concrete. Skardon and Fuchs maintain polite and sober fronts, but both are playing a dangerous game. One foot wrong and Fuchs could betray himself. One misstep and Skardon could reveal the gaping hole in the middle of his case. But as the conversation progresses, Fuchs starts to realise that MI5 are desperate.
Fuchs asked more questions, tried to put Skardon on the back foot, tried to probe a little bit about what sort of information he had, why he was making the suggestions that he was making. Skardon couldn't respond.
Skardon tries a new tactic. He tells Fuchs that he's going to be removed from the job that he loves due to his father's new post in East Germany. However, if he confesses his espionage, then he might be able to stay at Harwell. To Skardon's dismay, Fuchs doesn't bite. When the men break, Fuchs goes to have lunch with Ernest Skinner, and then he calls his dentist. Not his lawyer, not a friend, but his dentist. Hardly the actions of a man under duress.
He thought he'd got out fairly well of that meeting. He had not been touched at all by Skardon, and his story had remained more or less as he wanted to tell it. The visit had not particularly rattled him. It told him what he probably suspected already, was that MI5 or the security services were paying close attention to him, and that he needed to be particularly careful. But then he was always careful. So what was he going to do differently? Absolutely nothing.
Fuchs's life at Harwell resumes a veneer of normality, but it is just a veneer. MI5 have not given up the chase. Two further interrogations by Skardon follow, with new incriminating information drip-fed to Fuchs. It's a game of bluff. Skardon not having enough to incriminate Fuchs. Fuchs not aware just how much Skardon knows. Klaus Fuchs keeps his cool and by the end of the third meeting starts to sense that he's home and dry.
In these interrogations, I continued to play the scientist who had an understanding for the concerns of the security service. I got through these interrogations, and with them coming to an end, I could breathe again.
But what about those around him who now find themselves under scrutiny? Klaus Fuchs's friends, colleagues, and mentally unwell sister Crystal are all being endangered by his lies. Skardon has hinted at suspicions and potentially incriminating evidence around these people. The noose is tightening, but Fuchs can't be sure who it will strangle. For years, Fuchs has successfully separated his personal relationships from his life of espionage. But the partition is crumbling and it starts to dawn on him that he can no longer hide. Nor can he simply walk away.
In leaving Harwell in those circumstances, I would do two things. I would deal a grave blow to Harwell, to all the work which I had loved, and furthermore, that I would leave suspicions against people whom I loved and who were my friends and who believed I was their friend.
The life of a spy is a lonely existence. Secrets are entombed in a fortress of solitude. But Fuchs can no longer carry the burden alone, and he turns to his lover, Ernest Skinner. On the 16th of January, 1950, after his third interview with Skardon, Fuchs loads up his MG sports car and picks up Erna. Her husband and Fuchs's boss, Herbert, is out of town on a work trip to Liverpool. Klaus Fuchs and Erna Skinner head to Richmond in southwest London, where they spend 3 nights in the Palm Court Hotel. MI5 is winding down its surveillance operation due to a lack of both resources and results. There is no tail following the lovers on their weekend break, and no bug in the room. This is a major oversight. During the trip, Fuchs starts to tell Erna about the MI5 interrogations. Like a tightly coiled spring with the pressure released, he starts to open up. His internal unravelling has begun. Although Fuchs is sleeping with Erna, he's also very close to her husband, his boss, Herbert.
He and Herbert were very close. They worked together, they liked each other, and Erna had always been a flirt, and my understanding is she had other boyfriends in the past, and Herbert kind of knew about it, but, you know, he loved her, and they got along fine, and he let her have her little dalliances.
Oh, so they sort of had an open relationship?
Yes, she had an open one. I don't think he did.
Okay.
But he kind of put up with her flirtations and whatever. How far he thought they went, it's not clear. You know, it was complicated.
Over the next few evenings, Fuchs keeps returning to visit the Skinners at their home, and it gets emotional.
Herbert came to me and said, "Klaus, allegations are raised against you. If you assure us that there is nothing to it, then we will stand by you like a man and we will fight it through with you." There was a moment where I could not cope with it. As a spy, I should have been delighted. As a human being, there was suddenly the matter of human relationships that you can feel so closely bonded with friends that they placed all their trust in you. In this moment, I gave myself away. I can't remember exactly how it happened. It was practically within a second in which it became clear to him that the things were true. And it became clear to me that I had betrayed myself. And that for me, the thing was done.
On January the 21st, Klaus Fuchs calls head of Harwell Security, Henry Arnold. He trusts Arnold and considers him a friend. He tells him he wants a long, quiet talk. They meet for lunch at the Railway House Hotel, a few miles outside of Harwell, where Fuchs starts to offload and explain that he wants to meet again with MI5's Jim Skardon. Arnold listens intently and says little. He can sense the shift in Fuchs and doesn't want to make any mistakes. He agrees to help, and when they return to Harwell, he contacts MI5 and tells them that he believes Fuchs wants to talk, and talk a lot. Klaus Fuchs, one of the most influential spies in the history of nations, is ready to confess. Next time on The Bomb.
MI5, nor Skardon, nor anybody else had any idea that his spying had been that serious.
And he just looked at me, looked terribly shaken, but he just looked at me and said, "You realize what this would mean for Harwell?"
I mean, they both were absolutely devastated.
You can subscribe to The Bomb on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd leave a rating or a review to help other people find it. The Bomb was presented by me, Rosa Ellis. It was written and produced by Zach Brophy. The story editor was Emma Harding. Alice McKee was the assistant producer. Our producer in Berlin was Sabine Scherek. Klaus Fuchs was played by Marcus Calvin, with additional performances by David Hounslow. Sound design was by Tim Nielsen at Skywalker Sound and Eloise Whitmore. Original music was composed by Trevor Gorekis, with additional original music by Ben Marshall. The executive producer was Glyn Tansley, and the podcast was commissioned by Simon Pitts at the BBC World Service.